Welcome to the Entangling Web3 podcast for the 100th time. This is a very, very special occasion. Alec and I are going to be taking a look back at the first 100 episodes of the podcast. I can't quite believe, Alec, that's the number we're on. It seems like a bit of a weird dream that I'm in right now. But yeah, it's quite a milestone.
I know. I remember when we got to like episode 10 and we were like, that 99% of podcasts don't get to episode 10 or something like that. We're episode in the percentage of percentage. Yeah, exactly. We're in the percentage of a percentage right now. And I guess we know there's some people listed, which is nice. And it's not just my mom. I don't think my mom listens anymore, actually, which is quite annoying. But
yeah, your mom was probably the most mentioned person in the early days of the podcast. And I also remember having that feeling around kind of episode 10 and hitting double digits and thinking, wow, that was amazing. We made it that far. And I thought, gosh, it's gonna be a long way to get to triple digits. But, you know, fast forward nearly 2 years and all of a sudden it's here. It's pretty remarkable. And I honestly don't know where the time's gone. I don't know about you.
Yeah, we just look so much older. Maybe we're not more knowledgeable. We definitely look older. It's a bit weird. Like, I'm not trying to, like, it's definitely not affected the ego. But when I've been to a couple of conferences recently, and people have actually recognized the name. Like, I wore the hoodie that we have, and they're like, oh, you're from the Entangling Web3 podcast. And I was like, that's a bit bonkers. Like, do you know it for good or bad or whatever? But yeah, being recognized, like, by one or two people, even if they are, like, you know, in our niche, is really, really weird. But yeah, 100 episodes, it has flown by.
Yeah, you say you're kind of a pseudo celebrity now, Alec. You're big in the crypto sphere, apparently.
Exactly, to the one or two crypto events that still exist, there's some people that recognize us, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think I've definitely had a similar feeling that it feels nice. We seem to have a community of online friends now, which is quite fun. Like, from a lot of the guests we've had, you know, we've had people on multiple times on the show already, and we've kind of got a kind of trusted family. Obviously, we had our event last month where we had a few of those guys and girls along with us, and it was just really nice, I think, to see, yeah, it's not just us in our bedrooms anymore. We're actually out into the world. So yeah, I think what I think we want to do today is just briefly review what's actually happened to the podcast. Take a step back for a moment and look at what our journey's been so far, review some of our favorite kind of highlights and what's actually happened over the last 2 years. And then I think it would be interesting for us to look back at the first episode one, as cringe and as poorly produced as that one was, and look at some of the things we talked about and how that's changed over the last 2 years.
Yeah, it sounds like a good plan. Like, I actually re-listened to episode one recently in preparation for this, and it is bonkers. Like, it was really kind of made me cringe quite a lot to listen to it, to see. But also, like, it's probably a good thing, right? The fact that I'm cringing looking back 99 episodes ago to that shows how far we've come and how, like, the standard that we expect is so much higher now. We didn't have any video. I don't think we had any microphones. Like, I forgot that the reason this podcast started out was because we were trying to explain what our jobs were to people. And then, you know, we both say we worked in Web3 and blockchain, and people were like, what the hell's that? And we're like, well, we've got to start a podcast to explain it. 100 episodes later, still nowhere nearer to any of my friends understanding what I do.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And also, when we started it, I remember, you know, we recorded the first kind of 4 or 5 episodes before we launched the podcast, and we had written out a huge list of topics. I say huge, it was probably like 20 topics long. And I was worried that we'd hit kind of 20, 30 episodes and run out of things to talk about, but that's obviously not been the case. So much has happened in the last 2 years, as well as I think we maybe didn't realize how much we'd bitten off with this project and how many different facets there are to Web3. So, you know, on that, I think one of the things maybe just to mention is, so obviously we've had a kind of split of episodes between kind of content or topic episodes where we talk about specific things. So we've done 43 of those, and 57 episodes where we've actually had guests on to talk about, you know, their experiences or what they're doing. What was your favorite of the ones where it's just us, Alec, where it's just you and me talking into the abyss?
The ones of just us. I think that, you know, we started off as a kind of crypto-y blockchain focused, and it's definitely evolved, and we'll probably talk about it a lot later, how AI has kind of been, we kind of timed it perfectly in a sense, because we were this tech podcast and Web3 was kind of the umbrella term that we were using for tech. It's just that both of our passions and interests lay primarily with blockchain early on, so that's what we focused on early on. But then with the boom of AI that we all saw, I think that was one of the things that kind of we became passionate about, not just because it's, you know, interesting to see what's possible, but it's interesting the overlap and the integration and how it kind of has been quite intrusive into all walks of life, be it political, I don't know, like social, behavioral, absolutely everything. So I think any episode where we've been talking about that, because we can just talk from many different perspectives, not just the super techie perspective, I found really, really interesting. And the specific episode, because we've had a few on AI, that I really, really thoroughly enjoyed was AI and misinformation, because it kind of touches on so many aspects that did come from our, your previous understanding of blockchain and Web3 and what the kind of the motivating factors were towards that. When we talk about, you know, what is AI and what are the consequences of AI in, say, the social media space, I think the idea of misinformation and what role AI plays in that was really, really exciting and interesting to talk about.
Yeah, I think that's a great choice. I think AI has been, you know, virtually half the podcast at this point, which I didn't expect. And again, we kind of go through later on, I think, what has happened in the AI space since we began, because we've almost lived through that growth from kind of zero to one of AI. I mean, now on the weekend, my friends and family are using it and not even mentioning it, right? It's very weird because when we started this, we were using ChatGPT Corner in the very early days of the podcast. We'd get ChatGPT to explain things to us. And then over time, obviously, as that became more, you know, of a household name, and also because it was doing probably a better job than us, we ditched that eventually, right? So yeah, it's a good choice.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I forgot the little GPT corner. Like, that was an absolute novelty early on. And we dropped it because maybe it wasn't so popular. And maybe I think the reason that a lot of people go to podcasts, maybe not our podcast, is about the personality of the people. And that didn't really provide that personality. I think one of the bonkers things is we started off doing that as like a novelty. And it, you know, worked for us anyway. And we dropped it for whatever reason. But now you have so many podcasts that rely primarily on, you know, AI models, and you've seen, what is it, Google Notebook, that can just spin out an entire very human-like AI podcast instantly. And when that came out like 6 months ago, we were both like, damn, that's the job gone. but maybe that's one of the reasons, is people want personality. They want something. They want us to mess up, and boy, do we mess up. Maybe that's what people are drawn to the podcast.
Yeah, well, speaking of that, I think that's where I'd go for my favorite episode with just the two of us, would be our Zero Knowledge Proof episode, because that has our, I think, the best blooper when I'm trying to explain Zero Knowledge Proofs with the red and blue balls infamously. Because that was a good episode because it was a challenging one for us, you know, to research and explain clearly, and then also had a bit of a comedy element to it as well when we failed. So that was good fun.
That was like for the 20 minutes we spent trying to record that scene, the 30 seconds of output. I think it was the worst ROI of any episode. But yeah, definitely the funniest by far. I really enjoyed that episode because, again, it's one of those kind of core tenets, core pillars of blockchain technology and Web3 technology. It's something that has been on the rise, like more and more people are speaking about, even though maybe the practical use cases still aren't actually there. We're not seeing it like being widespread adopted, or at least like not commonly widespread adopted. But I think that episode was really interesting because there's so much you can do with it. And then when you explain it to people in quite simple terms, the benefits do make sense. It's just kind of getting the kind of, yeah, like I say, the mainstream adoption of those technologies. But I think, like, to relate the zero knowledge proof stuff back to AI, the idea of training AI, how do we verify and train AI? And the idea of, say, personal information breaches and what's actually being shared, and, you know, AI using data scrapers to get information that's available online, and people having a real problem with this. Well, zero knowledge proof can actually help with that as well. I don't need to share all my data. The AI doesn't actually need all my data for, say, certain very specific use cases for healthcare examples. Like, it needs the image, it needs the cancer scan, it doesn't need my name and identity, it needs to know that comes from, say, a trusted doctor. So I think zero knowledge proof is actually going to become extremely relevant for the AI agenda. And like we do with many things, linking a topic back to AI always adds a lot more value, because then you'll get loads of money to support the startup and spin out that actually makes it happen.
Yeah, always the perpetual pivot to AI. I love it. So yeah, that's the episodes with just us that bore everyone to death. What about the guest episodes? I know I've got a couple in mind, but what would you be your favorite, looking back at who we've had on and why?
I think actually related to that, it's Heather Leigh Flannery. She's one of my favorite speakers. I think she was one of our earliest guests, and we had her on talking about data sovereignty. She's an expert in digital identity, self-sovereign identity. And we've had her on for two episodes. So the first thing I thought about was the idea of, okay, we're talking about zero knowledge proofs being used to train AI and having this kind of human first approach to making AI useful and productive and all this kind of stuff. And the second episode we did with her was around that concept as well. Like, was it self-sovereign artificial intelligence or self-sovereign intelligence or something like this? And the idea of how can we train, we did that like a year ago as well, how can we train AI with a human first approach, the idea of data minimization, the idea of not having these, you know, these models going around scraping the entire history of humanity and everything on my Facebook and Instagram, but giving them very controlled bits of information that I could be monetized for, I could be rewarded for. And I think that's really powerful and links to, like I say, the topic that we were just talking about. She's an incredible speaker as well.
Yeah, I think plenty of people at home would agree with you on that one. I think Heather has been one of our most popular guests in terms of the episodes we've had. And yeah, she's someone I could just easily listen to. And I think she was probably the first guest where I was like, oh, wow, maybe we could make it as a podcast. I was like, yeah, this is, if we get people like this on all the time, then we're going to be okay. Because yeah, she's so articulate and so passionate as well. I think that was one of the big things, the passion she has for the industry. She's one of those people who's just, you know, working 24/7 to make these things come to reality. So yeah, I
inspirational. You're so right. Like it wasn't, it's one thing to be able to talk about a topic. It's another thing to being like a good speaker and inspire people on that topic. And she's like covering really complex kind of multifaceted disciplines, like bringing lots of different things together. I think that's really hard to do in a concise and, you know, kind of endearing way. And she does it and she inspires people. I think she inspired us. We were both at a low point for whatever reason at that time. We had her come on for the episode, I remember. And afterwards we were like, oh crap, that was so damn good. Like, I'm so keen on being in the Web3 space still. But yeah, that really sticks with me as like an absolute high point for the podcast. What about you, Jack? Which ones are your preferred? Yeah. Any guests that really sticks out in your mind?
Yeah, one in particular, very recent one. And on the same theme, I guess, of like, when we do the podcast, sometimes it can be, you know, quite an energizing thing. It's not always the case, but when we do it, you come away from it, which should be a draining, you know, hour of recording a conversation under pressure. And actually, you end up feeling more energetic about things. And the one I think of when it comes to that is King Willonius. So we just had him on very, very recently. And again, on the topic of AI, we'd spoken a lot about AI and its effect on the creative industries. You know, we did a whole episode of like on that topic just ourselves, and then he came on and gave us, like, you know, if this was a history exam in school, he'd be like the perfect primary source, right? Because he has been a part of a cultural moment generating AI, generating music with AI, and so he could speak to the actual ethical implications, the implications on the creative industry, the implications on culture in general. And yeah, and he was just such an interesting guy to talk to, you know, a comedian and effectively musician turned kind of programmer, AI engineer as well. Yeah, just super interesting guy. And I thought the way he explained things, it was just so, so fun to listen to. And I think that was, yeah, I know it's one of our recent ones, but definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah, I loved that episode as well. Like, I think we often hear about the negative sides. Like, it's always the techies that are pushing the idea of AI being more productive and, you know, buy my AI-enabled product and, you know, sponsor my AI-enabled startup. And it's often to the detriment of creatives, and creatives are often on the other side being like, oh no, this is going to take my job. This is going to replace me. I'm an artist, I'm a musician, all this kind of stuff. My job is gone. And I think there's a lot of justification to back that up, but it was really refreshing having an artist who's foremost, like first and foremost, an artist who came at it from the completely different perspective that we're often theoretically touting, but very rarely practically kind of doing. And that was, this lowers the bar to entry. Like, we say it all the time, but he's like, no, I spun up a song that had millions of listens in 15 minutes. And you're like, that is mind blowing. He was like adamant that this is the future for artists, and artists should be aware of this and pushing this agenda. And that was really refreshing. The other thing I took from that episode was how freaking uncool I am. Like, you were talking about BB Odrizzy and all these pop culture references and Drake versus this. I was like, what? I've got a different feed. Like, my feed's all like Dungeons and Dragons and random stuff. Like, I was out of my depth completely. I didn't let off to King Willonius, but I think maybe he knew.
Yeah, I think it was a surprising ego boost for me that I felt a bit more with it than Alec for once, because normally I come across as a bit of a robot. But yeah, and to be honest, I also like, because I know the story a little bit better from, you know, just being with it, Alec. It was when King Willonius explained how there was this evolution in the last couple of years that we've been doing the podcast, where it's gone from it being taboo to use AI in the music industry. And then when Drake did it, he said it kind of opened the floodgates. He kind of legitimized it for everyone. And now it's a free for all, right? And that's, that pretty much summarizes what's happened with AI, I think. So that's why, that's kind of why I like that story too.
Yeah, nice. I think, you know, 100 episodes in, it's also good to take stock of what we've actually achieved, because we recently announced that we hit 100,000 subscribers mark on YouTube, which is quite powerful. I know the number on YouTube actually saying is 175,000, but I said this at the event we did, and I wanted to reemphasize it, is that when we started, there was very little numbers on the screen, very few, like very few watches, mostly me and Jack. And then over like 100 episodes, to see those numbers go up, that's powerful. That's important. Like, it makes us feel validated that people are listening. But they're still just numbers on the screen. You don't know if they're real. They could be fake. Like, they could be. We've done a lot on fake accounts and fake numbers and fake people. And I think that one of the things that really validated it was twofold. One was the event we did in person, to actually have real people come and listen to us speak for a few hours, which is bonkers and was incredibly fun to meet the community. And I felt really validated by that. But the other thing was the fact that we got the 100,000 subscriber, you know, award, which actually, again, like, they do a little validation into all our followers to see if they're real or not. And they went, yeah, you've got 100,000 that are real. And you're like, oh, that's nice. Like, they're actually real people listening to us.
Yeah, it is nice. And, you know, it is very easy to get lost in the numbers, as you said. Like, we were celebrating our first 10 subscribers at one point, our first 100, you know, that was huge numbers. And it's definitely taken off since then. But yeah, for me, it's the most rewarding part has always been the engagement we've had, the people we've met. Like, we've had some amazing people on the show. We've got to speak to the likes of, you know, Jeff Garzik, one of the proper Bitcoin OGs who's been in the space for as long as it's been a space. You know, I really enjoyed that side of things and getting to know different people and having, I mean, I think it's, again, not numbers, it's the kind of stories or feedback personally that people are giving us, right? It's people dropping us a message or speaking us to in person saying, oh, I really enjoy that. Even, like, you know, colleagues saying, I really like that. You know, I go out of my way to listen to it every so often. It's like, oh, that's a nice thing that you don't have to do. So yeah, I've really enjoyed that side of it too.
I like that too. I probably do want to say that as well, is that we still get a few messages every now and again, like, to our personal accounts being like, oh, I've been listening to podcasts for a few weeks now. I really enjoy it. You're really helping me feel like I can get back into tech, or I can be more prepared for the AI revolution that's coming, all this kind of stuff. And you are right. Those personal stories really do validate and kind of give you, energize you, I think it's probably the best word. But yeah, there's been some other, like, big milestones as well. We pushed a newsletter out. We have over 1,000 subscribers, which has been going down quite well. And there's been nice steady growth on that, which has been fun. I think that trying to get, like, the opinion out to many different outlets is quite positive, because people take information in different ways. Like, I know I prefer podcasts and audio. Some people prefer reading, just like speed scanning and all this. Maybe one day we'll go to music and song and open mic stuff. We'll see.
Yeah, it's been a lot, because we've kind of gradually, you know, upped what we've been doing, right? As you said, when we first started, we were just recording the audio and putting out a pretty bad Canva video on YouTube to go with it, which wasn't great. And then, you know, 10 episodes in or so, we started recording video. Then we moved on to the studio eventually, had the newsletter out, recorded in person, you know, only in the last 4 or 5 months, which is really exciting. You know, first time me and Alec have actually seen each other in person since starting the podcast, which is good fun. Yeah, and then all the way to our first live event. So it's been a real evolution. Yeah, all I can say is I hope we never go as cringe as we were in those first episodes again.
And also our first sponsor as well, like getting VeChain to sponsor the podcast and believe in it, having Sunny on. They also sponsored the live event we did where, you know, we got over 60 people to come together in London with some epic speakers. Like, honestly, I was surprised how high quality the speakers were that came to the event. A lot of them were people that we've had on the podcast, some we hadn't on the podcast before, but it was Aaron Gore, Mulendijk, David Palmer, Pankuri Bansal, Sunny Liu, all speaking. And the feedback was everyone wanted to do it again, but go bigger. So I think we are going to do more live events. We'll just go bigger next time, which is exciting. It's kind of like, it seems like there's a lot of momentum.
Yeah, if there's one stat or metric I prize most of the whole 2 years, it's whatever Aragorn paid to fly in to be with us in London in person, because that's a real mark of respect from him. So yeah, shout out to Aragorn for doing that. What a guy.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions like recycling at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now, back to the show. Shall we talk about how the space has changed? This is obviously a Web3 podcast, a tech podcast, and we've done 100 episodes now, which is almost 2 years. Should we talk about like where we started and what we think some of the biggest things have been like over the last 100 episodes?
Yeah, sure. And I think, so when I went back as well and watched the first episode, it was fairly boilerplate, kind of covering, setting the scene for what Web3 is, talking about the whole journey, Web1, Web2, Web3, outlining the problems of Web2, how blockchain fits in, the level of the role of trust and things like that. And it had a lot of our opinions as well on things like, you know, how data can be monetized with micro incentives, data ownership, as you mentioned, all this kind of stuff. And I think it's interesting for me. There's been three kind of key themes throughout the last 2 years of what's happened, and it's some of it's trundling on slowly, some of it's moving rapidly. So I think maybe we'll start with there, with the kind of first bucket, which is, again, surprise, surprise, is that meteoric rise of Gen AI. So that's one of the most interesting things to me, is that when we started this out, it was so niche, as we said, it was not a huge thing. Okay, ChatGPT had already had its initial hockey stick, like it got it hit that record after it launched, and within 2 months had the fastest app or website ever to 100 million users, right? Just 2 months, that's insane. But it still wasn't the household name it is today, and we've watched that evolution, we've kind of covered it through the episode. So I think that's probably one of the biggest thing I would highlight in the last 2 years, definitely.
Yeah, and I know we talk about it a lot, but I still think there's value in talking about it, because I still meet people that have never used an LLM before, and I find it mind-boggling. But we maybe are in a bit of a tech echo chamber where we assume everyone is using it. Like, I'm using it several times a day constantly, but there are still some people that don't use it, our age as well, which is, I find bonkers. So it is still kind of becoming more mainstream. And I think even if people have heard of it and know roughly what it can do, maybe in a professional context, it's not at the stage where most people are using it every day in the same way most people are now using Google every day. But it will get to that stage. And I think that's the one thing, is it still is becoming mainstream adoption, like getting to the mainstream adoption. I think that is going to change to the point where everyone is potentially using it for every task where they interact with a device in the not too distant future. The other side is, the role and capabilities of these models are, you know, booming. Like, what it could do 6 months ago is completely irrelevant and doesn't even compare in comparison to what it can do now. Like, because there's so much competition right now, these models are having to constantly outcompete each other, constantly create new features, constantly push the boundaries, which I think is really exciting, and not in a profitable way, right? When we look at actually some of like the ROIs of these companies, a lot of them are burning money, but they kind of, it seems like they have this theory of, we just need to be the one surviving, get the most adoption, and then we'll work about how to be profitable after that, which is kind of, as a user, it's quite exciting, but maybe as like a business investor, but not so much.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to coin the term techo chamber at this point, Alec, for us tech heads in our echo chambers. But yeah, 100%. I think it's that is the characterizes the journey that we've witnessed since starting the podcast, is going from, okay, ChatGPT exists, it's hitting headlines, it's gaining traction really quickly. But now it's this hyper-saturated industry with this kind of blitz scaling model, as you just said. So it's like when you have the Uber and the Uber competitors come out, they're all loss leading, trying to be the one that survives. It feels that way with all the AI companies and models, right? You've got Google, Anthropic, Microsoft as well. And now, you know, the Chinese competitors with like DeepSeek and things competing with OpenAI, even though OpenAI spending something reportedly around $700,000 a day just to run ChatGPT. Like, it's insane the amount of money that it costs to do these things.
And I think on that, that's kind of worrying, because like, I don't know how dependent you are on ChatGPT or whatever LLM you're using, but I am extremely dependent for a lot of different things.
Alec is a front end to ChatGPT.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the face of it. I could just automate that bit as well. The problem is, like, when a server goes down, I do kind of see myself being stuck a little bit. Like, when OpenAI does shut down an hour every couple of weeks, whatever it is, I am a bit like, oh crap, like, I've definitely lost elements of my skill set that I used to have. I've become more and more dependent. So my fear is on the kind of the Uber side business model of one will outcompete them all, and then they'll potentially hike up the prices once they're the last man standing. You're like, well, crap, they're getting us quite sticky and becoming quite dependent on the services. Yeah. What's going to happen if, say, OpenAI is the last person standing and they can set the price of things? We are going to be in a position where most of society is potentially based on these services. What's going to happen then?
Yeah, and not only that, is the way we use them is all obviously changing as well. Like, the thing we've seen very recently in the last 6 months or maybe 9 months to a year is the shift towards agentic AI. So giving AI these new capabilities, this whole text to action model that we're seeing now. We've also had Model Context Protocol, MCP. If you haven't heard about that and you're into AI, then you've been under a rock, because it's everywhere at the minute, about how you can get additional data and resources into LLMs to use them. I don't think we should go into all that now, because actually next week will be a bit of a deep dive on the recent developments in AI, looking at DeepSeek and things. But yeah, I think looking back to episode one, I think there's a lot that we couldn't have predicted happening, or at least happening as quickly as it has, because it's been pretty mind-boggling, right?
Yeah, and I think that last point you made about the shift to agentic AI is very important when we talk about the mainstream adoption, is because there will always be a sect of society that won't want to go to a prompt and won't necessarily, you know, do the actions that it specifies. But when we start replacing entire jobs, entire roles, and people can't tell if it's a human or not a human, and we still stay in the digital space, then they will be interacting with these models. They will be interacting with agentic AI. It is going to be the norm. It's going to, you know, it's already just disrupting and replacing people. But when we start to have these open models that can operate in an open world and interact with each other through things like the MCP and through things like browser agents and all this stuff, it's going to be completely inevitable. So we do talk about it a lot, and sometimes it sounds repetitive, but there's a reason, right? It's like, what did people talk about when the internet was booming? Everything was on the internet, right? Like, it's a similar type of thing.
Yeah. And I think when you initially said, you know, there are some people who still haven't interacted with an LLM, I was actually thinking of caveating that. Like, there are some people who don't realize they've interacted with an LLM, but like, it's happening whether we like it or not. So it's definitely worth keeping an eye on. The second thing, when I went back and looked at the episodes, you know, initially, especially episode one, was we talked a lot about data privacy and data ownership. And I'm pretty sure I mentioned a couple of times my favorite guest we've never had on, Tim Berners-Lee, and his whole project. And I think that is, for me, I don't think it's fully gone mainstream yet as an idea, but it seems that there has been a kind of steady increased growth in awareness that this is a big problem, and also that new things like, for example, a blue sky can start addressing that. So for me, that was a big one. I don't know if you agree with that one, Alec, but yeah, that was my takeaway.
I think I kind of like compare the privacy and data ownership issues with also like antitrust issues that are going on right now. So like, to relate to what you're saying, I think people do understand the value of privacy. I don't think they understand necessarily the amount of information. Say your average user doesn't understand the amount of information that is being collected from, say, the Metas of the world. I don't think that is kind of in the forefront of most people's minds. I think they will still choose convenience and cost without, and privacy is maybe a third or fourth kind of on the levels of needs, on the levels of wants. But I do think from a corporation level and a governmental level, this is pushing to the forefront. I think we're going to see more and more pressures from governments to basically crack down on these institutions. Like the example that I give right now is Mark Zuckerberg with Meta going down to the antitrust about basically owning a monopoly. And I'm not saying those two things are completely aligned, having a monopoly on big tech and social media and privacy and data ownership, but there is definitely a causality there that when you are the gatekeeper, you can basically do what you want. And if, say, it makes it much harder for, say, a player like Blue Sky to compete in that space, even though they did have a meteoric rise with like 35 million users over the course of a year or something like that, it makes it much harder because of the network effect that Mark Zuckerberg currently has to basically compete. So it's kind of hard to offer alternatives that do put privacy and data ownership at the forefront when there's so much kind of stickiness right now in those solutions, in the Metas of the world.
Yeah, so it's a really great point, because again, in episode one, we mentioned a lot about this idea of platform lock-in and all the big social media giants and websites and apps trying to lock you into their specific platform. And that's directly related to this antitrust thing, right? It's like, can they lock you into an ecosystem of companies or apps that effectively control or have access to all your data? And yeah, interesting you mentioned about the kind of the ease with which, or the difficulty for Blue Sky, you know, despite how fast it was growing. And I think it's still, it's a huge significant milestone for it to even have around, you know, 35 million users now, how fast it's grown. To have a competitor, you know, I would never have predicted that a year ago, right? Because that's the kind of thing, it's built on this open source protocol, the AT protocol. Like, I would never have thought we'd be talking about it right now. I'd never have thought people like James O'Brien, right? Like the broadcaster in UK, like he's not a tech savvy guy. He does radio phone-ins about how not tech savvy he is, but he's on Blue Sky for one reason or another. And when I went back to look at the kind of growth figures for Blue Sky, today is the only time I realized that Threads had beaten its record for 100 million users. It took, I think it was like 2 hours, but that's obviously because
Threads had beaten the Blue Sky record.
Threads had beaten the OpenAI record. So ChatGPT, 2 months to 100 million. Threads took, I think it was either 2 hours or 2 days, but either way, it was much quicker, purely because existing user base, right? It's kind of cheating. It's not like zero to 100 million users. So yeah, that's a really good point.
I think on that stuff as well, like just to get in there, I think one of the reasons we did see the meteoric rise in Blue Sky users was political. And we're not going to go too much into that rabbit hole because we've got a whole, you know, episode on AI misinformation. But it was less about the solution. It was more like a kind of spoil your ballot type thing, right? It was more they were checking out of the existing solution rather than there was this fundamental technology that they were choosing over. It was more about the people that were behind the scenes running the two kind of competitors of Blue Sky and whatever it was, X at the time. So yeah, I take your point. It is a success story, but I think it should have been more of a success story if it wasn't for this, you know, monopoly that seems to exist right now. And another thing, just to kind of like hark on about it, is the thing that has kind of pushed the topic of data ownership and privacy to the forefront again is ChatGPT, the models, the LLMs. When people say, you know, one of the things I've seen more and more online is people doing right now in their little prompt, what do you know about me? And then it gives them all the information. And people are like, damn, you know a lot about me. Where have you found that from? And as soon as you start asking like where it's found this information, or whether it's scraped it, whether it's from the prompts you've given it, the answers get a bit weird and they get a bit like confused and they're not as transparent as you might expect. And I think this is kind of a growing effect that we're seeing, or kind of a growing movement of people being like, actually, these models know a lot more about me than I would have expected. Where is this information being pulled from? And I don't think we have the transparency into these companies to know exactly how the information is getting in there in the first place. And again, whether it's like the institutional or the governmental regulatory level that will put, or regulatory side that will push that hardest, or whether we are seeing a growing interest from the retail side as well to apply that pressure, I don't know. I don't know what should be the bigger movement in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think that has been a key kind of marker of what's happened in the last few years is the regulators and the institutions taking notice of this being a problem as well, right? Which I think is not insignificant. Like, you had a lot of probing around ChatGPT, as you said. I remember when they interviewed the then OpenAI CTO and they were saying, well, is it trained on my Facebook posts? Is it trained on my Instagram photos? And the answer she gave was pretty evasive, to say the least. So it was a bit awkward. And we also had the TikTok thing, right? The whole battle around potentially banning TikTok in various territories like the US. That's a very similar battle that the regulators have been playing for the last couple of years with these big companies and how they're using our data. So I think it's steps in the right direction. It seems, at least on the surface, that they are taking note, which is good.
And another interesting thing that you mentioned TikTok, and it does come into this whole antitrust monopoly thing as well, which is kind of bonkers that Mark Zuckerberg is actually using it. He's actually using the TikTok example as a reason why Meta's actually not a monopoly. So TikTok's actually worked quite favorably for what seems that their entire case right now about this antitrust monopoly, tribunal, is, you know, how can we be a monopoly when TikTok has risen so quickly out of nowhere, has hundreds of millions of users? Like, we aren't this thing. Competitors can exist and can, you know, push past our kind of, I guess, our web of ownership right now, our web of companies. And it's interesting that TikTok actually being used as this primary kind of reasoning that they're not a monopoly.
Yeah, it's like it's a bit playground, isn't it? It's like, Yeah, pointing at the bigger bully in the schoolyard is kind of funny. But yeah, so that's been something of note, I think, in the last couple of years that we've watched also. The final thing, when I was looking back, I think is probably the most boring, and it's ironic because it's one of the things we talked about the most in the early days of the podcast, but just what's been happening with crypto, right? I would talk about it as a steady march onwards of crypto and blockchain, because if you look back, we started, June 2023? So we're 5 or 6 months after the collapse of FTX, the SBF debacle, what happened with the whole DeFi contagion, Terra Luna collapsing, Silicon Valley Bank. It was all pretty bad news for crypto in general. And I think, although it sounds boring, the kind of steady progress of crypto and blockchain since then is kind of overperforming, in my view, for what could have happened when it was when the industry was facing a real kind of flashpoint there of, you know, all-time low reputation. So I think it's kind of made a steady recovery, right?
Yeah, you are right. It's maybe not the most exciting thing to talk about, because I think a lot of people who are interested in it know this like the back of the hand. But to see where the space was at 2 years ago, like, no one wanted to talk about it, no one wanted to touch it. It was one of those things where it's like, I don't know what's going to happen anymore. Could it die? And to think of, you know, who's in the White House right now and their opinions towards this whole space, it's done a complete 180. Like, to think of the regulatory side that was so aggressive towards like the crypto space in general, and almost all of those cases have been thrown out right now. And it obviously comes from, like, it's not just to say there's a couple of people who have, and I don't need to name names, who are very in favor of this space. It's the fact that there is a growing retail kind of, there's a retail side users, both in the US, but honestly across the globe. Like, some of the stats you see about, say, some of the most populous nations in the world, like Nigeria, like Pakistan, all these places, their crypto adoption of young people in those spaces is so much higher than it is in the Western world. And it's the sheer number of people now that are aware of these assets, whether it's for good or bad, whether it is a hedge against inflation or just to, you know, spin and make money and number go up, it doesn't matter. It's the fact that people are aware, are using it for something, and anyone who's trying to stop them from using something they want to use is all of a sudden in the headlines. And so all of a sudden the political movement goes towards it in like in a positive direction to support crypto generally. And I think you are right. When we started this podcast, that was not the case. Like, it was a bit of a no-no word. And all of a sudden it's now like the golden goose in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I mean, that's the one thing crypto's got in to its benefit, is that younger generations are always going to fuel demand for this for the foreseeable future, right? Because they're more tech savvy, they kind of understand the core value proposition, are less jaded by what's happened before, quite frankly. They haven't seen the kind of 15 years already. And yeah, the institutional side has been such a turnaround, right? Like, the narratives from people like Jamie Dimon and all the big banks, all the big financial players,
Larry Fink, honestly, like, yeah, the poster boy for it.
Yeah, it's been, again, if we knew back in June 23 some of the things that had now been said by these players, we wouldn't believe it, hands down. We think that's ChatGPT hallucinating or something. Like, this, it's crazy what's happened. And yeah, it seems like it's in a much healthier place now. Like, obviously Bitcoin hit its all-time high very recently. Was it just kind of in January? I've already forgot, or late 2024. Hit $100,000. Like, it's obviously not doing quite so well now, but it has had a pretty steady recovery. And, you know, I think it generally signals are pretty positive about the future, except for, you know, some concerns around, well, what are the other narratives that have come out? Well, meme coins, that's a bit more dangerous. Some of the things that have happened with those, you know, we've talked about that at length at the past. I know I'm not a fan, but yeah, it kind of comes with the territory at this point.
And the utility has to come. It's still not there, apart from like this, you know, hold of value. And we've seen that Ethereum hasn't been as performant, and like its relative price versus, you know, Bitcoin is so down because the narrative isn't there. The utility isn't there. People aren't understanding it for whatever reason, but that utility has to come. Like, there's so much money in the space. Like, even if there's 100 people just throwing darts in the dark, like, someone's going to hit the utility at some point. Like, I think the main things will be point of service, when we can start to use these cryptos in shops. And, you know, you see that in some places, but it's mostly gimmicky, right? To be the first pizza place in Argentina that has this or something like that. And I think we are going to see more and more that we can use this in a real utilitarian way.
Yeah, and I think like one of the positive narratives we've seen in the last, I mean, maybe more the last year than the whole lifetime of our podcast, but the stablecoin narrative is really kind of taking off now, even though for me, they're kind of boring and they've been around for so long. Right now, it's people are starting to realize, okay, actually using stablecoins for payments is quite a good thing. It can help hedge against certain highly volatile currencies for trade and commerce and things like that. So I think, you know, PayPal launching a stablecoin again would not have been on my bingo card for Web3 when we started the podcast, but I think that's another good sign of that kind of steady march on of progress. So, I think
that's an interesting point, right? Should these things coexist? Like, will they coexist? I think like the growing sentiment is there's a place for stable coins and for crypto and for fiat and for digital money and CBDCs and all this kind of stuff. I think we said previously, maybe just you and I, like on the podcast, that we're like, in a world in which crypto is the new norm and institutions and governments trust it, do we need stables? TBD. Like the volatility of Bitcoin is hopefully going down, maybe. Like if the volatility gets to a point where it isn't volatile anymore relative to fiat currencies, then why would you want a stable coin which is controlled by a single entity over a crypto that's controlled in an open, permissionless way? And maybe there is still a place, maybe we'll see a transition phase where there's still lots of volatility over the next 20, 30 years and stables play a strong role in there where they have the technology without the volatility. Or maybe we'll see a world in which fiat becomes the new volatile currency and stable coins are no longer stable. And maybe Bitcoin is the global reserve. Who knows? Like it is exciting to talk about this stuff.
Yeah, I think I'm a bit of a pluralist in terms of them coexisting. I think I absolutely see a role for stable coins. Even alongside just traditional fiat currency, I think it makes sense. There are certain benefits with how you can use it, things you can program in, the level of transparency you get. I think there are definitely use cases where stable coins have some advantages. And at the end of the day, it's which institution you're willing to place your trust in, right? You might have a variety that we can choose from that we don't really have. You know, we have more monopolies in the traditional financial world. So yeah, I think that it's generally good to have more competition in that area. I don't know how long it'll take before Bitcoin is a fully stable asset. We'll see. Maybe in 2 years' time we'll be saying that.
Yeah. So what's next for us? We've done 100 episodes. Is the goal to hit 200? Is it to hit 1,000? What do you think?
10 more years, baby. That's what we used to say, right? I think the future's looking good for us. We've got a really exciting pipeline of guests. I think that's been one of the nice things. We're getting better and better guests all the time. I think in general we're getting bigger people on with bigger stories to tell. So yeah, I'm excited just to see what things we uncover, and who knows what's going to happen in the industry for us to cover in the next few years as well, right? It's kind of, we're fortunate that we get to commentate on some of the madness that also comes along with it.
It's going to be huge. I agree. I think one of the things that has changed is at first we were like begging people to come on the podcast, and now we are actually kind of inundated with guest opportunities, which is the exciting thing. So the guests, yeah, obviously there's so many people to talk to, so there will be no shortage of guests. But unlike a lot of podcasts, the space is constantly booming. Technology is just, you know, increasing at an accelerating rate. Whereas like, I love The Rest Is History. I listen to it all the time. But there is only so much history. There's a lot, but there is only so much, like, right? But with technology, it's just constantly changing, constantly evolving. To think that 2 years ago, AI was just like a footnote, and now it is the thing that we're talking about most. Like, who's to say what else is going to come into, you know, the horizon that we can't think of right now, be it quantum. Maybe quantum will be the thing that we're talking about constantly in every other episode, and it really could be. But yeah, I am really excited for all the topics we haven't covered yet, and to see where the topics we have covered kind of go into the mainstream, because we talk about a lot of these theoretically, and I think we're really excited to kind of look back when they are practically adopted and be like, oh, how did this compare with what we said 2 years ago when we first talked about ZKP or quantum? Is it what we thought was going to happen? Was the future predictions we made accurate? And I'm really excited for that as well.
Yeah, and as you mentioned quantum, I think that is something I wasn't expecting to cover in quite as much depth as we ended up talking about on the podcast. And I think that's something we're quite excited to do, right? Is to branch out wider, much wider into the technology space, because at the end of the day, like Web3 is such a conglomeration of technologies, is going to touch lots of things in different industries. It's going to touch kind of lots of more traditional engineering and physical topics as well. So I think that's quite fun for us to cover. And yeah, it's if we take a holistic view, then we're definitely going to be talking about all sorts of weird and wonderful things on the podcast in the future, which is really exciting.
We haven't even talked about robotics yet. Like, I've got a PhD in it. We haven't even done an episode on robotics or drones or 3D printing. There's so many things that we can talk about. Like, honestly, the sky is unlimited or the future is unlimited. We've got so much to talk about, Jack. And I know you love these conversations, the highlight of your week. But yeah, congrats to us for hitting 100 episodes. Like, honestly, excited for the next 100, next 1,000.
Yeah.
All the way, baby. Going to be huge.
Excited to do another 100 episodes where I veto robotics as a topic. No, but yeah, thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone for joining us for these last 100 episodes and following us. If you've been here since the start, then I'm sorry, and thank you, and hopefully we'll continue to make these and get better as we go. But yeah, I think that's a good place to end this one, Alec.
Adios. Let's give him a new sign off. Adios.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.